him a few years ago, and he now says that the two men who confessed, he saw them stabbing the victim.
Hazeem, we're going to, Jeff, we're going to have to leave it there. The time is up for our show.
Okay.
Thank you so much for being on, and we're going to definitely follow
you.
Your case. Set Jeff free. As easy as that. Those three words, setjefffree.org.
Yeah.
Thank you, listeners. And Mark Cofield will be back next week. So definitely tune in to Think Outside the Cage. Thank you, Irene, for being there for us. And I will see you again.
Please help keep independent journalism alive and KPFK Radio strong. Become a Sustainer Circle member of KPFK by pledging at any level. $10, $20, $100 per month, whatever suits you. This is Verdeen White of Earth, Wind & Fire, encouraging you to make your tax-deductible donation today at 818-985-5735 or kpfk.org.
Hello, I'm Ian Masters, the host of Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org and heard on KPFK Mondays through Thursdays at 5 p.m. and on Sundays at 11 a.m. Background Briefing looks into three or four of the important stories and issues of the day to provide an in-depth daily briefing with context, history, and insight from the best-informed guests closest to the scene, who offer analysis and details often overlooked by the soundbite-driven media more and more controlled by Trump-friendly oligarchs. So if you want facts and information to inform a motivated majority to save our democracy before it's stolen next November, tune in Mondays to Thursdays at 5 p.m. and on Sundays at 11 a.m. for your Background Briefing here on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and worldwide at kpfk.org.
KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm director-producer Melissa Figueroa, sitting in for Susie Weissman, who will be back next week. On today's show, we spend the hour with economist and author Michael Roberts to unpack the teetering house of cards that is the U.S. and global economy at the moment, and how it is all connected to inflation, the Iran war, the AI bubble, Trump administration policies, and more. He helps us understand what's going on in the bond markets and why we should care, the crisis in private credit, what it is, and why it could also be a catalyst for an economic crash, why everyone seems to be getting it wrong on inflation and what to do about it, and whether and how and when we might expect a recession or a depression to be imminent. The discourse in the financial press seems to be talking about an economy that is wildly different from what we are experiencing in our day-to-day struggles, and we unpack why that is and what the implications of the anxiety at the top of this K-shaped economy are for the American working class. All this and more when our program returns in just a moment. Welcome to Beneath the Surface. My name is Melissa Figueroa. I'm the producer of the show and sitting in for Susie Weissman, who is on assignment this week. Today, we are going to go into a deep dive on the contours of the global financial crisis currently taking shape in multiple fronts and on a precipice on multiple fronts. It's almost like we're trying to figure out which domino is going to fall and crash the entire house of cards. This week on Monday, U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent announced a slew of what he called the most crippling sanctions in the history of the world against Iran, called Operation Economic Outcast. It's a regime of secondary sanctions against 60 foreign entities that are suspected of having economic ties or economic lifelines to Iran. The announcement of this crippling sanctions regime appears to have blown back on Bessent and Trump in various ways, not least involving the fact that such a regime would put it on a collision course with China, whose economic power is growing as U.S. economic hegemony is declining. We also saw Canada stand up to the United States this week with a trade war, with Trump promising sanctions to take effect on January 1st, ostensibly after the midterm elections, and Mark Carney slapping right back, putting a 50% tariff on hundreds of Canadian exports to the United States, effective immediately. So in terms of Operation Economic Outcast, it appears that the economic outcast is actually the United States, not Iran. Joining us to discuss all of this, the contours of the crisis, what all is going on in the financial markets, and what that means for us, is Michael Roberts. Michael Roberts is an economist and author based in the UK. He has worked in various financial institutions in the City of London for over 30 years. He's authored several economics books, including The Great Recession, published in 2009, The Long Depression, published in 2016, and Capitalism in the 21st Century in 2023. He blogs regularly at thenextrecession.wordpress.com. Welcome to Beneath the Surface, Michael Roberts.
Nice to be here, Mel. Glad to participate in this all the way from the UK, right across Atlantic and right across the other side of the continent as well.
And so why don't we start with that, with this cross-Atlantic political and economic alliance that the US and Britain has had that has been kind of a dominant force in the US economy since the Bretton Woods system was established. Mm-hmm. That system seems to be cracking in multiple ways, not least of which, as we can see most proximally to us, is the moves in the bond market. Now, a lot of people's eyes glaze over when they hear bond market, and it's always a very hard thing for people who are not trained in economics to figure out, because it's kind of backwards, right? Like, number go up means bad for some reason, right? But number is way up, and that actually means very bad. The 30-year Treasury yield has stayed above 5%, hitting a 20-year high of 5.3% last week. And Scott Bessent has actually, for the first time in decades, deployed U.S. Treasury resources. And this is important, not the Fed. The Treasury has intervened to buy back bonds to try to tamp down the spiraling interest rates. He also did the same thing for the Japanese yen 2 weeks ago. And each of those interventions lasted less than 24 hours before going right back to crisis conditions. So, Michael, if you don't mind, for us to explain to the listeners, why should we care about bonds? Why should we care about the yen? And why is the bond market this linchpin that really kind of is an indicator of impending crisis?
Well, for your viewers, bonds are what institutions mainly, but individuals could buy. They're a form of you're lending money. What you're doing is you're buying a bond from, it could be from a company or it could be from the US government, and they will issue this bond and say, if you buy this bond and hold it for 10 years, we'll pay you 5% every year in a fixed rate of interest over that period of time. So if you spend $1,000 on a bond and you've got a rate of interest that's fixed at, say, 4 or 5%, then you're going to get that percentage, which in this case will be around about $40 or $50 every year. Not a large amount, but it's guaranteed to be given to you over that period while you hold that bond. Problem is, if you're a bondholder, and most bondholders are the big financial institutions, the insurance companies, the pension funds, hedge funds, all the financial institutions, banks and so on, they hold these bonds, particularly government bonds. Why do they hold government bonds? Because the government is the safest borrower that you can possibly have. A government is not going to default on the bond that it's issued to you. It will guarantee that you get the money you deserve on that bond, and you get your money back after 10 years or 5 years, depending on how long the bond lasts. It's not like investing in a stock. You get your money back at the end of that period of time, and in the period of time that you've held the bond, you're getting interest every year. And the government bond is the safest form of bond to get. So usually the interest rate you can get on a government bond is the lowest compared to other bonds like company bonds, because companies issue bonds. It's a form of a loan to the company. Again, it's a bond that issued to. So NVIDIA may issue a bond to you. Meta may issue a bond. All the big companies can issue bonds. and that have different rates of interest because it depends on whether the bond purchaser thinks it's worthwhile buying that bond. So government's the safest. Problem is that you'll get a fixed rate of interest. So if I'm getting 4% a year on $1,000, that's something like $40 or $50 a year. But during that period of time, inflation could be rising quite sharply. So my $40 in year one might only be worth $35 in real terms the next year because inflation's gone up and so on. So the bondholder says, well, I don't fancy this. I'm actually losing money in real terms because of inflation. So I'll get rid of the bond, I'll sell the bond. But other bondholders or potential bondholders say, well, I don't want to buy the bond because inflation's going up. So you'll have to sell the bond to me at a lower rate. So if you start selling the bond at below what you paid for it, then the actual interest relative to the bond price will rise. So that's why we see the yields rise. So an interest rate might be 4% on a $100 bond, but because of inflation, people won't buy it for more than $90 in the market. So your 4% on 90 is actually worth 4.4%. Your yield has gone up because you're actually paying less for the $100 bond. So that's why it's upside down, that the yield tells you that the bond price is falling, that nobody wants so much those bonds. And that's what's been happening to US Treasury bonds over the last couple of years in particular. Why? Usually two reasons presented. The first is that the US government is running huge deficits on its budget, and the debt that it's building up that has to be financed by bonds is rising to levels not seen since the end of the Second World War. So people, bondholders, are saying, crikey, we're being asked to buy more and more government bonds. Can we be sure the government is not going to default on this and we'll be left with nothing in our hands? So we're reluctant to buy bonds at the prices that the government would like to get for them. That's one reason. I don't think that's the biggest reason. I think the biggest reason is inflation, that bondholders don't want to hold a bond with inflation rising very fast. So that's why we've seen yields rise, because they're trying to compensate the holders of the bonds for the rise in inflation. So yields will keep on going up if inflation keeps on going up. Now, in the US, I don't know, the average inflation rate is around about 4%. Of course, for lots of people, it's a lot more than that if they concentrate on food and basic necessities. But the average is apparently 4%. And incomes are not rising above 4%. They're lucky if everybody's getting 4% a year. In fact, they're not on their
about
wages.
3.2 on average, apparently, according
so
to
So we're
the
getting falls in real income. So the economy is weak. On the other hand, inflation is rising because of, as you pointed out, the Iran war, the deficits have been built up at the previous period. Right back to COVID, all the big price rises we had after the COVID, the big inflation spike. So if you look at average prices for things that people buy in the shops or purchase for utilities, they're probably 25 or 30% higher than they were in 2020. And they're still rising at a faster rate than the government and the Federal Reserve says they should rise. I know Donald Trump keeps saying they're falling, which of course is nonsense. Just today, the new chair of the Federal Reserve, Kevin Warsh, who was appointed by Trump to lower rates, because Trump says we need to get interest rates down, basically said, I'm not going to lower rates because inflation's going up. So he seems to be contradicting his own boss, as it were, in this situation. So we've got rising inflation, bond yields are rising. That's why the market is worried, not so much because the government is going to default on its bonds, because all it does is print more money to pay for them. But that just makes inflation worse if it does that. So we have this inflationary crisis. And at the same time, we have a weak economy. So it couldn't be worse, really, in many ways. We've got poor growth. We've got very real wages are dropping away. Bond yields are rising because inflation's rising. There's only one sector of the economy that's doing very, very well. Can you guess what it is, Mel?
The seven companies that power the AI industry? And with the AI, it's basically just those seven companies passing money back and forth and calling it profit. So, yes. I mean, in terms of the real economy, and again, I think the report just came out this week that the growth of the U.S. real economy, because you can't really count imports as GDP, so all of the chips and the equipment that's coming in for the AI build-out does not contribute to that figure, grew by only 1.5%, which is almost catastrophic in terms of a capitalist economy that needs to grow at least 3% or more to really be considered healthy.
Except for the very top companies, they released the figures just 2 days ago that corporate profits have risen compared to this time last year by over 20%. That's a record increase. We now have $4 trillion being earned by corporations in profits at the moment. That's a huge amount. It's gone up faster than it ever has done since the 1940s. So what does that tell you about the US economy? On the one hand, we have a small group of owners of big companies, energy companies, banks, tech companies, AI companies, making huge profits, NVIDIA making staggering profits, at least on the accounts. As you say, it's a lot of financial figure jokery pokey going on, but basically huge profit. Swathe of American companies that are smaller, medium-sized companies, they're not making much profit. And then when we come to workers, incomes are falling. People are only keeping up their consumption by spending on the credit card, by running down their savings, which are now quite low levels, to try and keep their heads above water in this situation. So we have what some economists call the K-shaped economy. Mm-hmm. That is, if you think of the letter K, goes up one side, the K does, and down on the other side. Up goes the very small rich, down goes the rest of us. That's the K-shaped economy which we have at the US in the moment.
Although I've also heard economists very recently start talking about the I-shaped economy because of the almost disappearance of the middle. It really is this very stark class divide between those who are able to participate in the financial economy, in which, again, as you said, the growth of fictitious capital can be astronomical because you can make up whatever numbers you want. I mean, Elon Musk had this projection of like 10 million Starlink subscribers. Like, anybody can just say that, right? And because that realm is all about psychology and like what can you convince investors to do, but at the bottom is the people like me and just regular working people who are finding our incomes, our purchasing power just erode and erode. The labor market has fallen through the floor. The last numbers for July saw something like more than 500,000 people in the United States have left the workforce, so they're no longer even looking for work. They're probably doing gig economy stuff, side hustles to stay afloat. And of course, 4.5 million people have been kicked off of food assistance, including over 1 million children as a result of the big, beautiful, in scare quotes, right?
The bill,
right. And the austerity, you know, and that's what I kind of want to go into next. One of the things about the bond yields, as we have discussed, is that it's also the bond interest rates are also an indicator, especially the 10-year yield curve is about the costs of borrowing. And so, as you said, the more and more that ordinary people go into debt and household debt is skyrocketing because wages aren't keeping up with inflation, they're having to borrow more. And that cost of borrowing is going higher and higher and higher. And that's not just for the people on the bottom of the K-shaped economy, but also at the top.
Certainly in the middle, because mortgage rates are at very high levels.
Absolutely.
Mortgage rates in the US are very much linked to the 10-year bond yield. Unlike in the UK, we tend to link it to our short-term rate, where the Bank of England sets it. But in the US, it's linked to that 10-year yield, and even the 30-year, because people have long-term mortgages. But if you want to refinance your mortgage now in the US, you're paying a lot more than you did last year and the year before that, and certainly since 2020. Not just a little bit more, a lot more. And that shows the impact. People forget that when they look at the prices in the shops, which are bad enough, that doesn't include the things that really hit you hard, which is utility prices, power prices, transport, and of course, if you're on a mortgage, then you've got mortgage rates up sharply. These are the areas that really cut into people's living standards.
Absolutely. And we've seen that drop in discretionary spending, although people are still spending, and people, the economists love to be optimistic and say, look, consumers are still spending. Well, yeah, we have to, because we have to live, right? But we're not.
You're borrowing more, you're saving less.
That's right.
Using up your savings. The data are there for the economists who argue this. The savings rate in the US has dropped to new lows. We haven't seen lows like this since the 1980s. That's an indication of how people are hanging in there by borrowing or using their savings in whatever they've got left. So that little burst we had in COVID, when everybody seemed to get a bit of money because they were sitting at home and still getting paid, or at least some of them were, that's disappeared now. We're really being wiped out by inflation and by increased costs.
Right. You know, in terms of the debt, a lot of ordinary working people in this country are turning more and more to this buy now, pay later stuff. And you see it now when you go to shop online. You can pay with Klarna or Affirm or any of these ones that give you installments. And what people don't really understand is that those buy now, pay later systems are tied not to legitimate banks or FDIC insured banks, but to private credit. And this is, I think, the hidden contagion in the system that, I mean, I'm surprised that it is not more covered in the press.
Very high interest rates, these particular.
Absolutely. Yeah, 10%, 20%, even 29 to 30% in some cases. But private credit has been going through a crisis for the last 6 months. And, you know, I've heard economists say that if it wasn't for the Iran war, this would be on the front page of everything. Because what private credit is the new subprime. After 2008, after the banks were forced to tighten their lending standards, private credit stepped in at first to offer loans to businesses, so new businesses, new tech businesses that wouldn't qualify for conventional loans. And now it's gone into this space with the buy now, pay later kind of things with auto loans.
Private credit, for the viewers who understand, is it's the credit that's floating into the economy, being lent and borrowed outside of what the banks are doing. Mm-hmm. So it's private companies setting themselves up as lenders, and how are they getting their money to make the loans? Quite often from the banks themselves. So the banks are connected behind the scenes or from insurance companies and so on. And private credit is to the banks and the insurance companies sometimes more profitable. Rather than lending directly to you, they can lend to private credit. Private credit lends to businesses and even individuals at higher rates, and as a result of that, everybody gains except the people who are borrowing. And this has been a dramatically big increase in the amount of lending that goes on in the US and other economies that's no longer going through the banks. It's uncontrolled, as you say, unregulated, and we don't know what's going on with them because these are private credits, so we don't see the accounts very clearly. And so this is dangerous. It could cause another financial breakdown and crisis in the future. But there are lots of things that could cause a financial breakdown at the moment.
Absolutely.
The AI bubble could burst. Mm-hmm. Massive amounts of money being pumped in and borrowed in order to do so by the AI companies and what they call, the viewers will know, the hyperscalers. That's the companies like Meta and others who are buying these AI products from the two main AI companies, which is OpenAI and Anthropic. And they're buying them. And where are they getting their money from? Well, they're getting their money from other sectors who are lending money to the hyperscalers, and the hyperscalers are lending money to the OpenAI so that they can keep going. And everybody's going around in a circle, which is now called circular financing. It's a bit more like musical chairs. I'm just waiting for who's going to be left holding the bag when all the shares go. And at that point, we could have another bubble burst in the next year or two. And that will probably have repercussions for private credit as well, because they're involved in this process. So the whole financial mess at the top is hanging on there, all with the hope that AI is going to save the world, or save the US capital anyway.
And even if it did meet the projections that have been promised to the stock market, what that means for ordinary people is data centers all over the place, people competing for water, competing for electricity. A single failure in Loudoun County, Virginia, where Data Center Alley is located, started a 10-minute rolling blackout for over 62 million people, over half the country. So again, when you come down to the materialist base of all of this, what this really means is that ordinary people are just getting squeezed out. You know, the other thing about private credit, I've been trying to sound the alarm on this for a long time. Private credit, just like crypto, right, has been one of these, like, what they call alternative assets. They're high risk and high return. So especially after the 2008 crisis, things like pension funds, life insurance, the long-term assets for ordinary working people have been firewalled off from investing in these high risk, high return kind of dodgy assets. However, in August of last year, Donald Trump signed an executive order that opened up these alternative asset classes to investment, from 401ks to public pension funds to union pension funds. And that was at a time when actually private equity was starving for capital. And so they were lobbying. Literally, some of these CEOs were seen having dinner with Trump at Mar-a-Lago, like they paid their $1 million and everything, to open up this vast source of capital to these private credit industries. And so not a lot of folks know the amount of exposure that their union pension fund, their public pension fund, their 401k, their annuity, college funds.
And what did he call this act, Mel? He called it the Genius Act.
Yeah. Real genius.
Well, it was
there.
Genius for somebody. Certainly for big finance, it was a genius idea. For the rest of us, we wait to see whether our pension funds don't go into default as a result.
Absolutely. I mean, CalPERS, which is one of the biggest pension funds in the country, like the unions have been fighting this in California because they, again, financial managers, they're kind of left to their own devices. So, you know, but when people started finding out that up to 17% of CalPERS is invested in private credit, this is, again, every union member should really be paying attention to this and really be leaning on your leadership to figure out where the money is and move it somewhere safer. So, you know, a lot of these things that we've been discussing, the sort of linchpin that is putting stress throughout all of these sectors is really, as you've been saying, the persistent inflation that has been plaguing the economy. And in the U.S. economy, you know, inflation has been persistent since right after the pandemic, really, for at least the last 5 years. And again, it's accelerated due to the oil shock and the Iran war. But that's also another mystery, because a question that a lot of folks have been asking since the Iran war started is, why isn't oil higher? Actually, some of that has to do with China, which has been able to basically turn on a dime, converting to solar, electric, and renewable energies due to their state-run economy, and also their stockpiling of oil reserves, mostly bought from Iran during the conflict. But you have this really fantastic four-part series on your blog, The Next Recession, that's thenextrecession.wordpress.com, in which you examine inflation from a number of different economic perspectives. Of course, your own being the Marxist perspective, which is mine as well, but also heterodox theories and the mainstream and monetarist theories. So, yeah, what's the deal with inflation? How do you see different economists kind of tackling this question? Why is it both so persistent and isn't even high enough when we figure in the oil shock?
Yes, well, viewers will know that prices in when we go to purchase goods and services rising, sometimes just a little bit, sometimes a lot faster at the moment. So not only do we have inflation at the moment, we have accelerating inflation. So it's worse than normally. During the decade of the 2010s, we still had a bit of inflation, but actually it was decelerating. It was dropping right down to 1 or 2% or even lower. The irony of that is that the Federal Reserve, the central bank, sets a target for inflation for the American economy of 2% each year. It wants prices to rise by 2%. Why? because it wants to give some leeway to the businesses to be able to raise their prices. It doesn't want them in a difficult position going bust because they can't raise their prices. It wants a little bit of inflation, but not too much, because then, as we can see, we discussed earlier, bond yields rise, cost of borrowing rises, they're forced to raise interest rates and so on. So it wants a little bit of inflation. This doesn't benefit workers in any way. We don't want inflation at all. We would like to see prices to fall. And that's what should happen. If we've got an economy growing faster, people working harder, being more productive, getting more goods out and services out in quicker time, prices should fall, but they don't. And so that's the key question that we have to consider. Why are prices still rising, sometimes at a faster rate, sometimes at a slower rate, when productivity is going up, workers are delivering more and more goods and services in less and less time on the whole? We should expect prices to come down. And there are a number of explanations for this. The explanations coming from the Federal Reserve and from economists in what I call the mainstream, that's in the universities and colleges, who are the experts and tell us everything about the economy. They have mainly two different theories. One is what's called the monetarist theory. And the monetarist theory says the reason there's inflation is because there's too much money in the economy relative to how much is being produced in goods and services. So if you think of it simply, if 100 units are being produced in goods and services, the money supply is about 100, then there should be no inflation, says this theory. But if the money supply is 110 and goods and services are only 100, then you've got a gap. And if the gap remains over a period of time, that means the prices rise to match the size of the money supply going into the economy. So the solution to inflation, says the monetarists, is to get money supply in line with the production of goods and services, then there'll be no inflation. Easier said than done, of course. Exactly how that was supposed to be done is not clear. If you squeeze money supply too much, people haven't got any money to invest, to spend, and the result is you actually get deflation, prices falling and have a slump. So it's monetary management. So the Federal Reserve runs around like a chicken without a head, looking to try and get this inflation rate just right with the right amount of money and supply. But the reality is that inflation isn't caused by the movement of the money supply. That's really a reaction to what's going on in the economy. Inflation rises for other reasons, to do with what's going on in the productive sectors of the economy, whether they're growing fast enough, whether they're providing enough goods to meet people's needs in wages and so on. By the way, that theory was exploded and has been dropped by most mainstream economists. But before that was also what I call the Keynesian theory. Now, Keynes said that what causes inflation is that there's too much demand in the economy. You know, people are spending too much, either governments are spending too much or workers are spending too much, more than there can be produced. And so what we need to do is to get that into line. The best thing to do is workers' wages are held down. Then they'll spend less and we won't have inflation. So there's a nice choice for us workers. Either we have no wage increases and we have no inflation, or if we have wage increases, we're causing inflation. This is an argument that's run for the last 150 years. Karl Marx was raised this point by other trade unions who said to him, look, if we ask more wages, the capitalists will just put their prices up and so we'll be back where we started. He says, nonsense. No, they won't. Why they don't want to pay you more wages is not because they're worried about inflation. They're worried that their profits will fall. Yes, they may be able to try and raise their prices, but probably not, especially if your wages are being too low for them to buy and the investment's not taking place. Inflation is down to what's going on in the productive sectors of the economy. So this wage push theory has also been exploded, because during the 1970s, we had inflation, and yet we still had wages low and unemployment high. We had what was called stagflation then, when the economies weren't growing, unemployment was up, but so is inflation. How's that possible? I'll tell you what the latest theory is, Mel, the one that central banks and all the big international experts say. It's your expectations. You expect inflation to rise, and so therefore inflation rises. Because you expect it, you go out to spend more before it rises, and so you cause inflation in the prices because you spend more in trying to stop you losing too much money before the price rises. So this is it. It's down to the stupid behavior.
It makes even less sense than the other
two. If they just stopped buying too many toilet rolls all at once, they wouldn't cause inflation. This is, I have to tell you, this is the main argument presented now, inflation expectations, because they've run out of other theories. Uh-huh. And, of course, it's a question you have to just ask viewers is, well, how did prices start rising in the first place? They only rise in the first place. Then people say, oh, prices are rising, so now I better go and buy some before they rise again. Better go and get my gas now before it goes up another 10 cents before the next day. But first of all, prices have to be rising. Gas prices have to be rising before people start expecting them to rise. So expecting doesn't create inflation. Expecting is after inflation. So this is a ludicrous theory. So that summarizes the main theories of inflation presented to explain inflation. There are alternative theories, which as you call heterodox theories, which is they're not orthodox, they're off-piste, they're not on the golf course. These theories, well, there are a number. First of all, there's too many monopolies in the system. They control their market and drive prices up, and therefore they get big markups, and that's what causes inflation. Well, it sounds a promising theory, but then you realize, well, there's always been monopolies. Inflation hasn't always risen. So can it just be the question of markups by monopolies or big companies taking advantage of price rises? Again, it boils down to the same thing. Prices start to rise, costs and so on. Big companies can take advantage of this, as they did do after COVID, and slap prices up. But the vast majority of smaller companies can't do that. They're price takers, not price makers. They suffer accordingly by increased costs. The degree of monopoly in an economy isn't really an explanation for inflation. So that's why I come back to what I think is the Marxist theory, is that we need to look at two factors in inflation. The first one is how much is being produced and what's the value of what's being produced over a period of time. It's called the value of the total commodities being produced, goods and services. How do we measure that value? Well, we measure it in how long it takes for us to work to produce it.
Right.
So if we go to work and it takes, I don't know, 1,000 hours for a worker to build a car, or a car's worth 1,000 worth of labor time, as opposed to a Bic pen, which might be worth 10 seconds of labor time, we can see that prices depend on the amount of labor time that goes in to making them, producing them across the economy. Now, if the increase in that value of labor time means more growing in the economy, but if the growth of labor time starts slowing, either because there's not more workers coming in, or they're not being able to work as long hours as they did before because they're being laid off and so on, we have a slowdown in the number of hours being produced. That usually reflects the fact that the economy is going down, that things aren't doing well. So what do the central banks do? They say, oh, the economy is going down. We know that the solution to this is to pump more money into the economy. So what they do is they open the gates for the lock and let money flow into the economy. And they hope that this will then cause an increase in production because businesses will have more money to spend at lower cost and so on. But what quite often happens with most of this money is it goes into financial speculation by the banks and doesn't go into productive businesses to invest. So nothing much changes with the investment rate. So the result is there's more money in the economy caused by central banks thinking there's a slowdown and that that's what they have to do to put it right. What's causing the inflation is the difference between how much this money supply growth is at any one time and how much the total number of labor hours to produce things are increasing. The difference between the two gives us a sort of an inflation rate, which we've called the value rate of inflation. It's not quite the same thing as the inflation rate in your shops when you buy things. That's the consumer price index, as the officials do, and that changes all the time. And that's what most people look at when they look in the papers, the inflation rate's gone up. They look at this consumer price index and whether it's gone up. But the value price index, or the rate of inflation, is actually a lot higher. That's because it takes a lot more hours than the official figure suggests to get the goods that you require. So in many ways, workers are continually having their incomes in terms of the hours they have to put in to get their income reduced over a period of time. Real incomes, in that sense, have been falling for decades, not just in the recent period because of price indexes going up faster than wages. The underlying feature of the theory of inflation presented to you by me anyway, and by other Marxists, is that it's not to do with how much money supplies in the economy as such. It's not to do with workers demanding too much wages. It's not to do because suddenly consumers rush out to buy too much too fast because they're expecting prices to rise. It's not just to do with some companies being able to hike their prices because they're big companies and they're monopolies. That wouldn't apply to the vast majority of companies. So it can't be due to that. It's due to the fact the underlying weakness of the economy, it's slowing down, productivity growth isn't so good. This means that capitalists find that their profitability starts to fall in, they don't invest. The whole thing starts slowing down. And the official authorities, like Secretary Besant or Kevin Walsh, they'll buy bonds. They're going to pump more money into the economy to get it going. All they do is cause inflation by doing that. So then they reverse that policy. They realize it's causing inflation. So don't be worried. Next year, rates of interest are going to go up because inflation's got too high. Kevin Walsh is already talking about it. Besant will stop buying bonds and they'll try to drive up the cost of borrowing to try and control inflation. Of course, what they will do is not actually control inflation. They'll just drive the economy into a deeper possibility of a slump or recession.
Which has happened in many of the last few business cycles is that you see the economy start sliding. The central banks will raise inflation rates because they're operating on that theory that you said, yeah. And it just drives it straight into a correction period.
Stagflation in the 1970s, where the economy's not growing, but inflation's going up.
Right.
We could have slumpflation this time, so that actually have a fall in output and a rise in inflation, because this inflation is driven by international events like the Iran war, by the cost of producing and transporting goods across the world. This is increasing the cost for companies. It's making it much more difficult for them to sustain a reasonable rate of profit. So I'm not talking about the very top companies. I'm talking about the majority of companies. So that productivity and investment starts to slow. And the reaction of the officials is to pump money in. So they end up with no growth in the economy and inflation. That's the risk that we have over the next year. There is one caveat to that. The big caveat is that maybe, just maybe, the huge profits that are now being made by the Magnificent Seven and these big companies in the tech world and in the AI and Elon Musk with his SpaceX, all these companies apparently making huge profits, maybe their level of profits will trickle through the rest of the economy, increase profitability, and therefore raise investment for the rest. Because this is the argument that's presented to us. AI is going to transform American capitalism and world capitalism within the next year or two, and then all companies will get more profitable. Of course, they'll only get more profitable by laying off half of us from jobs and reducing our ability to get good jobs, reducing us to just monitoring AI bots. That is a strategy which suggests that we can overcome inflation without having a recession. Kevin Walsh, as I mentioned again, the Fed chair, when he was appointed, he said, the most important thing is the AI revolution. And the AI revolution is going to step change productivity and bring inflation to an end. That's the big hope. So I put it on the caveat, not to rule it out, because you have to recognize that these are possibilities, that these companies are making big profits. Will they divert these profits, if they really do exist, difficult to judge, into the rest of the economy? And that could make a difference. But at the moment, I don't see it.
Yeah. And especially given if you look at what you've laid out here in terms of a theory of inflation based on the labor theory of value, what is the socially necessary labor time for an AI whatever, like what is the socially necessary labor time to create a Bitcoin? It's literally just pressing a button, right? And given that, it's like the introduction of AI that's supposed to increase productivity, although according to Dean Baker, who's been looking at the numbers, there's actually no evidence that AI has increased productivity at all. It's just replaced labor. And because AI doesn't have really the demonstrable capability to actually do what a human does, you know, a lot of companies are finding out that they've, you know, adopted AI, laid off a bunch of workers, and then the AI doesn't work. But those workers are gone. The company can't get them back. They're not going back into productive activity.
What happened in COVID, where lots of companies laid off loads of workers during COVID, didn't re-employ them, and then found they were definitely short of staff and couldn't actually meet the commitments they made. They overcome that by raising prices to some extent. Yes, it's absolutely right. We have no idea whether this AI bet is really going to work. And the evidence so far is, even if it does work in raising productivity, it's certainly not going to happen in the next 2 or 3 years. It's going to take way, way more than that.
And it's going to take way more capital expenditure than they ever expect to get back from profit.
Astronomical already. Astronomical.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's just like the math just does not work out. And given that the AI industry is now, you know, responsible alone for 75% of US GDP growth, it's just a very frightening situation in terms of just the amount of hot air let's just say, that is driving the US economy right now. Yeah, so that inflation piece is one piece of this thing that's driving the crisis, and one of the reasons why the economy doesn't look like it's behaving the way that mainstream economists expect it to. The other thing that, you know, going back to the bond market, and one of the things that's driving up bond yields is also the decline in US hegemony, both military and economic, that has happened as a result of the Iran war. And this is a huge deal because, again, all of the things that you've laid out, as well as some of the heterodox theories like MMT, modern monetary theory, and others, they always kind of pose this way out that has to do with government intervention in terms of QE, like you're saying, putting more money into the economy or tightening the money supply through interest rates, although that's never worked. But all of this is sort of predicated on the assumption that the US dollar will always retain value because there's always going to be demand for the dollar because the dollar is the world's reserve currency and what is used for the buying and selling of oil around the world. That equation is now changing because of the Iran war. And one of the reasons that Bessent can't find anybody to buy treasuries, because a lot of people are moving their money out of the US government debt market. Again, government bonds having always been considered a safe haven, U.S. treasuries in particular are no longer considered a safe haven. A lot of economists will say that this is due to the ballooning size of the national debt, the $40 trillion, and, you know, this idea that the government could default on the debt, which is highly unlikely. But a lot of it is also due to the fact that now there are alternatives that are existing to the absolute primacy of the petrodollar as the single currency by which you can buy and sell mainly energy, but also other goods in international trade. And a lot of economists are kind of banking on that fact when they don't see a crisis on the horizon, or they have a more gradualist theory, right, of how the shift can happen. This is now changing quite a bit. Since the start of the Iran war, central banks have been dumping U.S. treasuries. Turkey, like, basically dumped their whole U.S. treasury reserves in one go. For two reasons. One is that they needed to have that dollar liquidity to buy oil at inflated prices. And the other is because, well, who wants to hold this debt, right? And they're really seeing the instability and the fundamental fiscal fragility at the core of the U.S. economy, and they're looking elsewhere. They're coming to gold to just kind of sit tight. But China has been rising ever since Iran closed the Strait of Hormuz and started charging tolls in yuan instead of dollars for the oil that's passing through. China has, I believe, two cross-border payment systems. One is the SIP system that's among the central banks, and Enbridge for more commercial transactions that basically uses the yuan instead of the dollar as the constant by which foreign exchange can take place. And Deutsche Bank 2 weeks ago became the first European central bank to actually sign on to the Chinese system, which is huge. I mean, this is an earthquake in terms of international monetary exchange. It really has that shift away from the dollar. The ECB is also debuting its own repo facility, which basically does the same kind of function that the Federal Reserve window does in terms of providing liquidity into the system. That's supposed to come online in the fourth quarter. So you're seeing actually both the EU and China moving towards building the infrastructure that would be necessary for an alternate currency to function as a reserve currency. This seems to be one of the reasons why Bessent is so desperate to like throw around his economic flexes, because dollar dominance is going away and I think he knows it. So how is this de-dollarization of the world? And I think this is another one of those unpredictable, maybe not unpredictable, I mean, us Marxists have been saying that for a long time, but one of these unexpected twists in the economic story that really goes to the heart of the assumptions that economists and central bankers have. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I think you're right about the question of how big central banks and government bodies around the world are trying to shift more and more out of dollars. When they have reserves in dollars, what that means is they've bought treasury bills and they hold them in the New York Fed. And that's the way, just short-term bills, they can cash them in quickly. And they're slowly getting rid of those and transferring it to other alternative currencies to some extent, or to gold. But the reason the dollar has not really collapsed, and if you look at the data, you can see the dollar is still holding up pretty well. The reason is because most of the money coming into the US to finance and keep the dollar up is all these companies and governments and elsewhere buying US equities, buying US companies, buying stock, the stock market in the US, which is booming. They can make lots more money. They may shift it out of the treasuries, the official central banks and the governments, but the private sector is pumping its money into US equities. So it's keeping the dollar up. But that's a risky thing. Because if the stock market in the US should collapse, then all these...
The eye bubble pops.
If that bubble pops, then all these foreign investors in US equities are going to be getting burnt and they're going to be shifting out. Then you would see the dollar come down quite sharply, and will demonstrate that what's happening at the moment, the dollar is no longer depending on its ability for the American economy to sell more exports in manufacturing and services than it imports. It hasn't been doing that for 40 years, but it's no longer in the position where it dominates completely the financial transactions that are taking place in international trade, although it's still the majority. And increasingly, the dollar depends on having these foreigners buy its stock market. Of course, they're not allowed to buy too many companies, particularly if they're Chinese, but they could buy the stock market. So everything is a bit on the edge in terms of, if the stock market bubble goes down, then the dollar will suffer. And we'll actually see the relative decline of American capital compared to other countries, particularly Asia, of course, and particularly China, as a result of that. It hasn't happened yet. So we still have the exorbitant privilege that the Americans have in having the dollar. When I say the Americans, I mean American companies, banks, financial institutions. They've got a dollar, which is relatively stable. People seem to want to buy it. They still trade in oil, mostly in dollars, certain and other commodities, and they still do most financial activities in that. But if that bubble bursts at home, that situation could sharply change. I think that's how I see it at the moment.
Yeah, it's almost like, because bonds were a safe haven, it's no longer a safe haven. So people are putting their money into the riskier areas. Yeah. And yeah. So this actually just compounds the scope of the contagion that is going to happen when the AI bubble bursts. Not if, when. Just in our final minutes here, I'd like to try to maybe game out this scenario with you, because there's so much. It is almost like this house of cards that's held up by multiple things, and all of those multiple things are cracking all at once. You know, we're seeing shades of 2008 in a shadow banking crisis in private credit. We're seeing shades of 1999 to 2000, the dot-com bubble. We're seeing that in the AI bubble. We're seeing shades of the Asian financial crisis with the collapsing yen, even the bond crisis. And again, one of these hidden things that people aren't comprehending at the moment is the just monumental amount of margin debt that is holding up this stock market that you've been saying is now the thing that most people are putting their capital into.
Margin debt means that if you want to buy a stock at $1,000, you only have to put in $10 and you borrow the $990 on the margin.
Right.
And that's right. A massive amount of leverage going on, guys, mm-hmm. in order to go into the stock market. Stock market's going up, it's going up, it's going up, so I don't just borrow more and keep making more money.
Yeah, I believe it's the Shiller-Cape ratio, the price-to-earnings mm-hmm. ratio, that at least when I checked last month, it's been a month, so I don't even know, was 44 to 1. That's the ratio of that debt to the earnings.
Well, the stock market price.
Yes, the stock market price.
The earnings you get for the stock you hold. And
exactly.
That 44 is nearly as high as it was in the dot-com bust, which mm-hmm. took place in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
So we're back at those sort of extreme levels. So the stock market is way out of line with what's going on in the real economy, as we like to call it. What's going on for earnings for the majority of companies, apart from, of course, our magnificent seven, hold the whole of the US economy up by their hands. Dripping with borrowing themselves, so we'll see whether they can continue to do that.
But the real frightening thing to me is that the dot-com bubble burst, but at the time that it burst, it did not have nearly the amount of leverage in the stock market than it has now. And I forget the indicator that's relevant here, but I do believe in 1929, this amount of leverage as opposed to the sort of real capital in the game was something like 33 to 1. And it's something like half again that right now. So it's like all of these things are coming together. I know we can't look into a crystal ball, but we can certainly figure out some scenarios. So as we head out of the third quarter, and the fall is usually the reckoning time in financial markets, because third quarter earnings come out, people start to see how the year is going to play out. And that's when you see the Black Mondays, Black Tuesdays, these collapses in the stock market. So just in terms of how you're seeing, you know, the lay of the land, what are some possible scenarios that you could see playing out? And what will that mean for us in terms of how that comes down on the working class, and how can we start preparing?
Well, I think from what we've discussed up to now, I think viewers will be coming to the conclusion that a stock market is in a bubble driven by AI, and it's very likely to crash, as we've seen before. The question is, will that crash lead to anything significant for us in our households or at work and so on? I think the answer to that is yes, because it will mean that a lot of so-called profits will disappear. They'll turn out to be fictitious when this stock market crash takes place. That will mean companies will start laying off workers because they're not making the profits they claimed they were going to make. The prospects don't look so good at going ahead. I mean, they'll still have inflation. They might even have higher interest rates. It's a situation which could go into American economy going into recession. And I'd say this, Mel, that when America sneezes, the rest of the world has terrible flu. And that means that US is absolutely vital to the world capitalist system. I mean, it's the most important economy. If Britain has a slump, which it has done, or Germany has a slump, yes, that's bad news for German people and British people here where I am, but it doesn't change the world much. Mm-hmm. If the Americans go into a slump, that will change the situation considerably. It could be in for 1 or 2 years, really bad years for working people around the world, both in the global north and, of course, in the global south. When we come out of that, who knows? Will AI productivity deliver? Will it mean that companies will grow fast, the economies will grow faster, and we'll be in a new era of higher profitability and higher productivity? I'd just like to warn, we shouldn't rule it out. It's a possibility, and that therefore a big slump can actually create the conditions for a nice boom afterwards, which can last for 3, 4, or 5 years. But all I would say, leading up to the end of this decade, here we are at the middle of 2026. We've still got another 4.5 years to go. Midterms, we've got another presidential election in over 28, if we have one. We've got 4 years. I think I can hardly imagine that it's likely that we will have some sort of stock market crash and slump within those next 4 years in the US. And that will bring other economies down. The history of booms and slumps in capitalism is fairly regular. Every 8 to 10 years, there's a boom. A boom ends and we have a slump which lasts for a year or maybe a little longer. It may be deep, it may be shallow. But every 8 to 10 years, that happens. So just go back a few years. I don't know how the viewers how old they are, but if we just go back in the 20th century, you've had a shallow one in 2001, a mega one in 2008-9. We call it the subprime financial crash, but also an economic bump of severe nature. And an even mega one with the pandemic slump. It lasted a shorter time, but it was much even deeper than the Great Recession of 2009. And do you notice that's 8 to 10 years? 8 to 10 years.
Right.
So the next one is likely to come probably by the end of this decade. That's the scenario. After that, maybe capitalism goes on again. Unless we working people do something about it, we need to organize to ensure that we don't continue with this internal, recurrent crises and slumps, which takes people's livelihoods away for a generation for some people.
Absolutely.
And creates the conditions of increased poverty around the world. Nothing is being done about climate change. Nothing is being done about the growing dangers of war.